Hey, it's Thomas Frank. I've just got a quick note for you before we get into the show. If you've been enjoying the Inforium or my videos over on YouTube, then you, my friend, should get Nebula. On Nebula, you get ad-free versions of both this podcast and my videos, along with exclusive stuff like extended versions of those videos. And it's not just our stuff that you're going to get. Dozens of other creators are on Nebula, including Ali Abdaal, Wendover Productions, Braincraft, Tier Zoo, and lots more. Nebula gives us a chance to experiment, and since everything's ad-free, it's also the best way for you to get our content. Head over to theinforium.com/nebula to sign up now. Hey, what is up, everybody, and welcome back to the College Info Geek Podcast, the internet's best resource for getting ahead as a student or even a non-student, because we don't really talk about student stuff that much anymore. We just kind of talk about productivity. Anyway, it's a good resource for getting ahead. Bad resource for learning how to start a punk rock band that only has songs that last about 7 seconds long.
All right.
I'm a little long-winded.
That's fair.
So
you're definitely not going to work for that. That's fair.
Not gonna work for that. What did I just do to my hair? I don't even know. I've been trying to improve the quarantine hair a little bit.
Yeah.
But guess what? I'm stoked. Denver is allowing hair stylists and barbers to start working again tomorrow.
That is true. I did get an email about that. Got to wear a mask in, but can get hair cut.
Yep.
I'm probably
got to wear a mask. Not... They won't do like hair washing. They'll just do the cut. They won't do beard stuff. That's fine. I cut my own beard.
Yeah.
Pretty easy. I'm not doing the Seneca crane swirls. Maybe I should, though.
Probably.
Martin, I've been thinking. I've been making up all these terrible resource jokes for the intro to the podcast. We're starting a new podcast, or at least new name, in like 5 or 6 episodes. So here's what I'm thinking. Let's let other people decide what our show is a terrible resource for.
They probably do know best.
They probably do know best. So, dear listener, send us funny ideas for what the show is a terrible resource for. You can tweet them to me, at Tom Frankly. Or where else should they send them? Or put them in the YouTube comments. Yeah, put them in the YouTube comments, but tweet them to me. I do sometimes.
Okay.
It's actually kind of a funny observation I have made where like the bigger something gets social media wise, the less inclined I am to go and check the comments on it because there's just so many comments.
Yeah.
And when my YouTube channel first got big, I assumed like, okay, I guess I've just like passed that part of life where I check every comment. But the interesting thing is when the YouTube channel for the podcast started, because it was small, like it was like my brain reset. Like an episode getting 1,000 views on the podcast channel was exciting again, even though an episode getting 1,000 views on my YouTube channel would be like, oh no, the business is going to die. and as a result, because there's usually only like 10 comments, I go and read them. I usually don't reply to all of them just because I have a lot to do, but I do read them. But I will say, if you're going to send funny intro ideas, the best place to send them would be Twitter, because out of all of my platforms, I would say Twitter is the place where I probably at least see stuff. Most guaranteed. Email is terrible because there's like 100,000 people who want to put guest posts on my website. So it's gotten to the point where like any email that's more than 3 sentences, you just have to like scan it. And if you see the word guest post, you just delete instantly.
Yeah, I get the same thing. And I don't even put that email anywhere. I still get like 100 spammy things.
I was thinking about this whole like, mismatch between the person receiving an email and the person sending an email. Because when you're sending an email, you want to make it worthwhile, so you think, oh, I should add more detail to it. I should make it, you know, this great, finely crafted email. But from my perspective, as somebody who gets hundreds of emails, possibly a day, the shorter an email is, the better. Like, if there are paragraphs, I'm just like, this is a giant task, and there are many other tasks. So it's kind of an interesting little dichotomy. Anyway, send us your joke intros, and we might use them. Yeah. I think that'd be kind of fun.
Yeah. We gotta do something. Gotta say something.
We gotta do something. Hey, Martin, I wrote a song yesterday.
Yeah, like the whole thing start to finish, or you finish the song?
The whole thing start to finish. I want to do some production tweaks. I may go back in and do a couple of recomps for a few areas where there was fret buzz. But yeah, I just sat down and so I filmed a video yesterday about how to kind of trick your brain into doing work. And it was this sort of observation that I've had where when I sit down at my computer and say, I'm going to write a video, I'll usually feel very stuck and it's very tough to get started. Yeah. But when I'm like sitting in my chair over there reading, I have my distraction journal next to me and I will often get a tiny little thought like, oh, hey, I might want to add something to a video later. So I'll start jotting it down and then I'll end up with like 6 pages of notes and the entire video is outlined. So the kind of whole idea was like work is like a non-Newtonian fluid. If you ease into it, you actually can ease into it. But if you try to like slam your face against it at 1,000 miles an hour, it just turns into a brick wall and you can't get into it at all. Mm. And music is exactly like that. Whenever I'm like, I'm going to make a song, I just get overwhelmed thinking about everything there is to do. And it's almost worse than a blinking cursor, because at least with a blinking cursor, I know what I must do. I have to write words. But with an empty project in my DAW, I'm like, oh man, I could start with drums. I could start with guitar. I could start with vocals. I don't know where to start. What do you do? But I just was like, all right, well, I'm not intending to write a song. What I intend to do here is see if I can double track just a chord progression on the guitar. And for people who don't know, modern music, when you record the rhythm guitars, typically, they are doubled, which means the artist will play a chord progression and then they will replay it again and make it as close as possible to what they played the first time. And then in production, you take the first take and you take the second take and you put them right on top of each other and you pan one to the left and one to the right. And what this does is it makes the guitar sound a lot fuller. Almost all modern music does this now. And you'd think, oh, well, I could just take the same guitar take and duplicate it and then just pan it left and right that way. But the problem is when you have the exact same take, the panning just cancels out and it sounds in the middle again, or wherever the middle of the positioning would be. But when you actually double it and you get it close, it sounds the same, but there are minute differences that create this wider sounding soundstage. So if you want to have good sounding recorded guitars, at least for rhythm, you need to double it. So yesterday I'm just like, let me just see if I can double this really simple chord progression. And I got something I was kind of happy with. And then once it was there, I was like, oh, hey, I can kind of hear this little melody in my head. I'm going to play it out. And by the end of the day, I had a song that I was pretty proud of.
Nice.
So yeah, now I'm just going to work on some little production tricks, cleaning it up, and I'll have a new study track out pretty soon.
Cool.
Pretty stoked. Yeah. You're working on music too, right?
I am indeed working on music. I've been working on...
It's one of the few things we can do.
A couple things for a while.
Mm-hmm. Mostly piano stuff, or have you been getting more into like production with your computer?
I have not been doing anything on the computer. I got one instrumental piano song that I wrote like mm-hmm. earlier this year, but I'm redoing some of the fingering techniques for better playing style. I got to relearn part of it. It's a little difficult. Then I got another song that's also piano, but technically speaking, I'm somewhat calmly rapping over it. It's like a poem over the piano, basically.
Okay.
That I'm still working on the music for, because I just redid all of the underlying music to, I want it to now dynamically match the feeling of the lyrics better.
Cool.
So it started like out really repetitive, but.
Is it like a rhyming poem, or is it more like?
Oh, it rhymes. I wrote it like I was writing rap. It just doesn't feel like rap when you listen to it, because it's a like piano in the background with no drums, no beat. Or
gotcha.
Anything.
So it's not like aggressive rap.
No, but... no. I mean, it's not aggressive at all. It's just a song about my stepdad that I lost. So it's basically as if I had written a letter that has a lot of rhymes in it. That's it over piano.
Yeah,
but I've been working on that for almost a year at this point.
Dang.
Just because I keep coming back to it
and
doing something else.
I need to get better at working on music long term.
What do you mean?
My problem is I will make something and then I'm like, I want to just publish it and get on to the next thing.
I wasn't in a place to publish this one, so I have a little bit of an advantage because I was like, I'm not ready to put this anywhere if I do it all. And I wanted to, and I redid the music underlying it. Now, this is the second time. So the third version of how the song could sound in general. Actually, the fourth version of how this song could sound in general, because I keep coming back thinking it's not quite right. But that's because it's a particularly meaningful track. So
yeah,
it's harder to move on from than if I had just thrown some stuff together. Maybe I take too long because I'm real perfectionist about a lot of it.
Yeah, I would say that even for tracks that aren't as personal for you, you tend to kind of let it marinate in your head for a long time.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, there's a definite advantage there. With my music, I don't know how to play it. Like, everything I've ever released, I couldn't play it for you because it all just pours out of me and then I'm done.
Oh, yeah. I have the sheet music for the one that I'm mastering the technique for. I have the transcription and everything. It all stays in there. So it takes me a little bit because every like month or so, I'll just come back to it, playing it, and then kind of freestyle part of it and be like, that was better. We merge it into the original now. And then
that's a frustrating thing about music is like when you're creating music, you start to have this realization that, you know, a song, it doesn't like exist before it's created and you're working towards it. It could be any permutation. You could change a melody here, change a melody there. It would make the song feel different. So what you end up with is just one possible version of a song. I guess like the EDM community seems to embrace this, or I guess like maybe embrace is not the word, fight against this more than most other genres, because the EDM community more than any other genre has remix albums where you'll have one track and then, you know, 15 different producers do their own spin on it, and it's a release of one track, but it's 15 different versions of it.
Is it usually pretty similar in like the bass chords that are used for it?
I mean, yeah, you can definitely tell like it's the core kind of jazz like
in the sense that it's you can tell that's the song, but in jazz you'll also have tons of improvised stuff.
Yeah, when you listen to these, I probably have some sitting in my Spotify that I could pull as an example, but I can't think of one right now. But you can always tell it's the song. Like the heart of it is there. Actually, a great one is, and this is not really EDM, but Ellie Goulding, I think she has a song just called like Lights or something like that. There's a zillion remixes of Lights. She did like a half an hour medley version that mashed together a bunch of remixes some years ago. And, you know, in a lot of cases, I'm like, dang, I like this remix a little better. So it's kind of cool just seeing how artists and that area of music just sort of embrace the fact that a song could be all different kind of versions of itself. And they happily share all those different kind of versions.
Yeah, and it's a good genre for it.
It definitely is.
Not every type of music. Like the song for my dad would be absurd to release. Remix album. I've got like a ton of it would be completely inappropriate.
Yeah. I
mean, but for that kind of like those genres, it makes a ton of sense to be more musically free with it.
Yeah, if you're making dance music or something. I love it when artists, like this is very common in the rock community, will release a stripped album or an acoustic album. My favorite example of this is the band Icy Stars. They have their album Treehouse, which is one of my favorite
I see like ever. With my eyes, not icy.
Yes, I see with my eyes.
Okay.
I see stars. And Treehouse is one of my favorite albums ever. But then they released this reimagined like acoustic version of the album that has, I think, six of the songs from it. And I like it better. And they did such a good job with it. It's not just like, oh, hey, let me just like play my song on an acoustic guitar. They went and got all these acoustic instruments and added in strings and they're like rearranged versions.
So they made it like, what if the soul of this song was transferred into an acoustic song?
Yes.
It would be absolutely like this, rather than just saying, what if we just cut out all the instruments and play that part on an acoustic and then call it good?
Yeah, for anybody who has not listened to that album, I would highly recommend going and listening to Treehouse by Icy Stars in its entirety and then listening to the acoustic version. If you don't like post-hardcore with EDM influence, then go listen to just the acoustic version. I mean, I think even without the original context, it's a fantastic album that you'd really enjoy. But with the context, it's even better, in my opinion. I think that's kind of why I love remixes so much and covers, because I get the context and I get to see a new permutation of it. And for me, that's fascinating. I know some people aren't as huge on covers, but... Oh, while we're talking about covers, my friend Noah from Polyphonic put out a video about cover songs. Freaking work of art. Yeah. So we'll have that in the show notes. Yeah, the dude is so good at After Effects, and the video is great too. And one of the key points kind of focuses on what I would say is the best cover song ever written, which is Jimi Hendrix's version of All Along the Watchtower. Anyone who's seen Watchmen has probably heard that song before. The original version is great too, but for me, the cover just is like the version of it. Anyway, we got five questions today.
We do. There was the bonus music discussion. That's the secret sixth question, which you didn't hear about. Boom. It was, what's your music writing process like? There you go. Bam.
Doesn't have to be bonus. The podcast is here for us to just chat, man.
It's true.
With some loose structure. The structure, the crystalline structure belongs in the videos, which are highly scripted and take a long time. This is for us to just kind of riff. We got five questions. So every once in a while, we do an episode like this where we take five questions from Twitter, from Instagram, if we happen to check DMs, which doesn't happen super often. Sometimes email, sometimes YouTube comments for the podcast. Y'all know how to get in touch with us. We typically see stuff. So we have five questions. We're just going to kind of riff on them. And if you have five questions you would like answered, dear listener, then send them to us. Twitter's probably the easiest way, because I can easily just copy the link to a tweet, put it into Slack, and be like, yo, Martin, is this a good question? Should we put that it in a little database? And that is what happened with these questions. So the first one actually came from email, and I just noticed right off the bat that it was a fantastic question, so I really wanted to talk to you about it. The question is, what is your consumption to production ratio? So this was sent to me by somebody who has a full-time job, and they felt a little frustrated because after they would get back from their full-time job every day, they would spend a lot of time going through online courses or learning, and you know, they had a lot of goals, but they noticed that outside of work, they seemed to be consuming a lot more than they were producing. Even if it was, you know, productive.
Meaning in like a media sense.
Right.
Like they're not eating way more pizza than, you know, they produce.
I don't produce. I eat a lot more pizza than I produce.
Yeah, your ratio.
I would say I have a 100-0 pizza consumption to production ratio.
That's fair.
But, you know, I could start making pizza, though. Learn how to make pizza dough. Then I would be a little more balanced. But no, this is for output versus input in terms of learning and doing creative work or work that you find meaningful. So he asked me, like, you know, what is your consumption to production ratio as somebody who's a full-time content creator? And my answer to him was that it's not really fair for you as somebody who doesn't consider your full-time job to be included in that production component to try to compare to somebody who does consider their full-time job as part of that component there. Because for me, like, I produce a lot more than I consume.
Yeah,
or I at which least, would be natural. I at least produce 50%. You know, it would be at least 50-50. Just because I spend 8 hours a day producing in some capacity. And you know, some of that is research, but a lot of it is editing or filming or writing or whatever. It's a lot of production. So what I said is, I think it would be better to think back to the one experience I have had, which was similar to his current life situation, where I had a full-time job and then I would come home and work on things after that. And that was my internship after my sophomore year of college, where I worked 40 hours a week in a big financial company, worked in a cubicle, and then came home. And I think it's actually a great place to make a comparison, because that was when I was building College Info Geek. And I think even then, I had a pretty good amount of production as compared to my consumption. And for that, I would attribute the whole 1% rule and the power of being on a schedule. So I know, and I think you know, if you aren't forced to produce on a schedule and you are the kind of person who is maybe a little perfectionist or who really just wants the work you're creating to be great, it can be very easy to watch just one more tutorial, to buy just one more self-help book, one more business book.
Yeah, you're never quite ready to do it well enough.
Exactly. I want to make videos, but you know, I don't know really great camera techniques. I better go through this course. I really don't know how to do editing very well. I better go through this course first, you know, because I don't want to put out something that's crappy. So let me go through these courses first. And the problem there is when you're only in learning mode, you're not actually learning that effectively because you're not getting your hands dirty. You're not putting what you're learning into action. So it just kind of sits into your brain, or it kind of goes into your brain and sits there as information you ostensibly know, but can tie to no real world experience that you've had.
Yeah, it's so, like that. Yeah. There's that quote that I like that's, in theory and practice are the same, but in practice they're not.
Mm.
So you could watch as much as you want or read as many books on the topic as you want. And if you never do it, the second you do it, you're going to be like, I feel a different level of understanding than you could ever just achieve on an intellectual level.
Yeah, you have to do it. I'm going through a course on Adobe Illustrator right now. And one thing that I force myself to do is anytime he shows how to do something, I pause the video and do it, even if I don't need to. And if there's a keyboard shortcut for doing it that he mentions, I will do the keyboard shortcut. Like, even if he's like, you know, all right, we're going to go to window, we're going to open this thing. Oh, by the way, here's a keyboard shortcut for that. I'm like, all right, cool. Let me actually press the buttons. Because if I'm just like, I acknowledge there's a keyboard shortcut and I can remember that it is Command Shift G, that is not the same thing as actually hitting Command Shift G and seeing the thing happen as a reaction to your input.
Yeah, you need to build the intuitive understanding in addition mm-hmm. to the intellectual understanding.
Yep. So I guess my one piece of advice here is if you feel that your consumption to production ratio is skewed too far in favor of consumption, then use the 1% rule. Find a way to put yourself on a schedule when it comes to production. And with each thing you produce, find a way to push yourself to up your game by 1%. Now, 1% is an ideal. I don't think there's a way for us to create some universal formula where you quantify, you know, how much you could possibly improve from one project to the next and then force yourself to only do it by 1%. You know, some videos I would say I pushed my game by 50%, and some videos it truly is like, yeah, it was just a kind of incremental thing. But it's more of a philosophical thing. Find a way to make sure that you can say when you look back on this most recent piece of work that you did not rest on your laurels completely.
Yeah.
Find a way to say I did something better. So for music production, we can break that down into a zillion different components. With this song that I did just yesterday, my guitar playing is better than it's ever been, for sure. But that's, you know, that's something I do every day. I play guitar every single day. So just have better guitar playing for me is like, I could justify that as my 1% rule over my last song, but I would like to hone in on something a little bit more concrete. So, you know, double tracking the guitars is something that I could point to. I've never been that good at double tracking, and my double tracking is a lot better this time. Or I got a little bit better at going in and setting my EQ purposefully instead of just choosing a preset. I actually listened to the song. I pulled things up at different frequency bands, actually identified areas where, you know, I need to pull down the signal at a certain frequency band, otherwise it's kind of harsh. And boom, now I've actually, through doing, learned something that I didn't know how to do before.
Yeah.
Now with music, the one piece I'm missing is there is no publishing schedule.
That is very true.
Which there probably should be if I want to be serious about, you know, making music. The only reason I'm just serious about making videos is because there's a publishing schedule.
No, we'll set up like a competition of sorts that doesn't really have any winners. But every month, we each got to write a song.
Ooh, I love this.
Then
okay.
We got to show each other what we came up with.
Does it have to be public?
I don't know. I don't know if it has to be public. I mean, what if you were saving up to make an album? You wouldn't want every song to be public necessarily.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
I mean, some people do it like that, but that's not how I did it.
The album thing is interesting. The band, oh God, what's their name? The album's title is Sundowning. Oh, Sleep Token. They had a really interesting way of releasing their album. They did it one track at a time every 2 weeks.
Yeah, I've seen a couple people do stuff like that.
I think there are defenses of the concept of the album in 2020, but they are weaker than they've ever been.
At least if you're not trying to loop the music. If it's not like a conceptual grouping that matters, if it's just like a loose collection of singles.
Yeah, definitely depends on what kind of album.
In that case.
If you're making a concept album, it should come out all at once. If you're making one of those albums where all the songs bleed into each other, it should probably come out at once. And there are a lot of defenses for like, hey, an album makes a statement as a collective whole. And if you're just releasing singles, you know, you don't get that. But there's also, you know, the counterpoint there is authorial intent often gets twisted by how the consumer chooses to consume the media. I listen to albums out of order all the time. My listening style is to take one or two songs I like from an album. I'll add those to my like songs, and those are all I'll ever listen to.
Nope.
I'm just not the kind of a person who sits down and listens to a whole album. I know you're different.
I also barely listen to music in general. So,
you know, oh man, I listen to music
every
constantly.
Once in a while. I might put on an album, but for the most part, I don't listen to anything.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing you have to kind of come to terms with as an artist. You put something out into the world, not only to share it, but ideally for people to consume it and enjoy it in the way that you intended. And once it is out in the world, it will inevitably be consumed in different ways. People will chop it up, people will remix it, people will turn it into a 30-second cell phone ringtone or something.
Yeah.
And some artists get really angry about that.
Well, I mean, there are some copyright issues on some of those things. But
there's copyright issues,
but like,
for sure. But
you
like,
can't
some
control
artists get, some artists get like
art.
Fundamentally mad that people are enjoying their content in a different way than they intended. Like there was this recent controversy about Ariana Grande. Like she had this whole video where she basically subtweeted some other girl for acting like her on TikTok. And she's like, imagine being an artist who put in all this blood, sweat, and tears to make this exact thing. And then somebody goes in and reinterprets it in a way that I don't like. I don't know. Like, I guess I understand the feeling. But when you put things out into the world for other people to enjoy, like, you gotta have to know. You know, people are going to do things with it that you didn't intend. And as long as you're not breaking the law, like, you might not like it. But at the end of the day, they're still enjoying something you made.
Yeah, I mean, make fun of them all you want, but you can't expect to control them.
Yeah.
Unless, again, there are copyright issues. In which
case, I mean, if they're stealing from you might that's an issue. To. You know, but if people are like I've seen people say, like, oh, it's disrespectful to turn on a YouTube video and listen to it, like turn off the screen of your phone. It's like, is it? You're still giving attention to the person. If someone watches my video as a podcast and they don't get to see all the cool animations I put work and time into, they're still paying attention to things I created. Like, I'm grateful for that. Would I prefer that you enjoyed all my cool camera tricks and stuff? Sure. But even the people who are watching, like 95% of those people don't understand the work that went into it.
Yeah.
So
it takes like a billion years to make a 5-minute video. And yet it takes us only about an hour to create this hour to 90 minute podcast. It's completely reversed.
This is a great production to output ratio for podcasting.
Yeah.
But there's a very good production to fulfillment ratio for my videos. And even if people don't, you know, if the majority of people don't understand, all the work that went into it and what's going on behind the scenes, that's fine, because I got the satisfaction from doing it. I might get some satisfaction from the feedback I get on it, but the majority of that satisfaction comes from simply doing the work and making the discoveries for myself. And that's how it should be. Because if you're getting all of your satisfaction from the feedback you get from others, eventually it won't be enough.
Yeah.
You become desensitized to a particular level of feedback, and then you need more to get the same hit. And eventually we all fade from relevancy. We all hit a plateau or a peak. It's just what it is. So you must learn to derive satisfaction from the work itself.
Yeah.
Anyway, my main tip on the production to consumption thing is, again, 1% rule. Put yourself on a schedule, get 1% better, which getting 1% better requires you to go learn and consume.
Yeah, you don't necessarily want to only ever be producing, because then you could create 200 videos doing one thing completely absurdly and spending way more time on it. And maybe one video you could have watched would have unlocked a technique. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, so this kind of neatly solves both extremes. If you're the kind of person who just produces at the same level, always on, you know, always resting on your laurels, having to get 1% better requires you to go out and learn. But being on the schedule requires you to actually produce as well.
Yeah,
it's just a sort of system
balance.
Mm-hmm. And this is kind of how I think about like everything: is can I devise some sort of system that forces me into a boundary box that represents good balance, healthy balance?
Yeah.
And I'm not always great at it, but that works for me.
No one is always great at it. They just have to be great at it a balanced amount of the time.
That's true. We're always we are all the pendulum arm swinging from one unhealthy extreme to another, hoping that some force will push us back into equilibrium until we are unceremoniously pushed out of equilibrium once again.
It's more entertaining anyway, than staying in balance.
Equilibrium's a good movie. There's gun fu in that movie. Christian Bale's in it. It's pretty good.
Fair.
This week's episode of our show is brought to you by our friends over at Brilliant, which is an online learning platform for anybody who wants to boost their mastery in the areas of science, math, and computer science. Brilliant has a library of more than 60 in-depth courses, including a complete full math suite. And all these courses are based on the practice of active learning. So when you go into one of their courses, you are going to immediately be presented by challenges, by problems, things you have to sink your teeth into. And in building courses this way, the team at Brilliant knows that, number one, you are going to be more interested when you take them, because instead of just sitting back passively and taking material, you're doing a little bit of that, but then you're immediately applying what you learned. We actually talked about that in this episode. Now that I'm thinking about it, the whole idea of consumption to production ratio. If you're just consuming, if you're just intaking, then you're never connecting what you're taking in to real life experiences. And that means the information just sits up in your brain, connected to some stuff, but not connected to the neural networks and the neural groupings of neurons that really matter, that actually have to do with what you're doing in real life. So that is another reason why Brilliant is great. You are interacting with the material and figuring out how to use it. Now, within their library of courses, again, you're going to find that entire math suite with a brand new redesigned course on the fundamentals of mathematics, which is a great place to start if you're looking for a refresher on mathematics, for a jumping off point for going to algebra, for going to statistics, for number theory, all kinds of great stuff. And it goes all the way up to the very, very advanced stuff, stuff that I've personally never touched, like differential equations, calculus 2, all kinds of stuff like that. There are science courses covering gravitational physics, covering classical mechanics, and computer science courses like an intro to Python programming, ones that get into the nitty-gritty of algorithm design, and lots, lots more. There's a neural networks course that's pretty new, an intro to search engines, lots of great stuff. So if you want to start learning today, head over to brilliant.org/collegeinfogeek and sign up. And if you're one of the first 200 people to do that, you're going to get 20% off your annual premium subscription, which gives you access to all of those in-depth courses. Of course, with their free plan, you get access to a feature called Daily Challenges. I've talked about it many times in the podcast before, but it gets you one new problem every single day that you can use to, number one, make problem solving a daily habit, which over time makes you a universally better problem solver, and number two, exposes you to new areas of study that you may not have considered before. So once again, brilliant.org/collegeinfogeek and be one of the first 200 people to sign up to get 20% off your annual premium subscription. Big thanks, as always, to Brilliant for sponsoring this episode and supporting our show. And another big thanks goes out to our second sponsor this week, which is Skillshare. If you want to boost your skills in the areas of graphic design, marketing, productivity, business analytics, video editing, illustration, all kinds of creative skills that can help you boost not only your overall creativity, but your job prospects, Skillshare is an excellent place to be. Their library has thousands of classes covering all these topics, plus a couple of classes from yours truly. I've got one on building strong habits and one on building productivity systems, the interplay between your to-do list manager, your calendar, your task manager, your file organization system. If you want to figure out how to make all of these things work in tandem, well, that's a great class for you. But the class that I want to promo today is actually one that I am going through personally. And that class is called Adobe Illustrator CC Essentials Training by Daniel Scott. This is a nearly six hour class on all the fundamentals of Adobe Illustrator. And I'm going through this class right now because I would like to learn how to do all those cool motion graphics in After Effects with custom illustrated assets. I can use little shapes that I draw in After Effects. I can do lines, I can do boxes and circles, but anything more complex is currently beyond me. But I at least know that I need to use Illustrator to create those assets, and then I can port them into After Effects. So after meaning to do it for a very, very long time, I'm finally going through a formal class on it here on Skillshare, and I'm gonna learn how to make some cool stuff in Illustrator. Right now, I'm drawing this this falcon. I'm gonna put it on the YouTube version. I drew this falcon in real life, and I'm going to recreate it in Illustrator. And yeah, it's pretty hard right now, but I'll eventually figure it out. So, if you would like to try Skillshare out, number one, it's a very affordable learning platform at less than 10 bucks a month with an annual subscription. But you can also get a 2-month free trial by going over to skillshare.com/geek. and signing up. So again, you're going to get completely unlimited access to the platform for 2 months. You can take my classes. You can go take this Illustrator class and get even better at Illustrator than I'm going to get. Probably not. I was saying that, but no, I'm pretty competitive. You're not going to get at Illustrator.
Definitely.
But you can try. And again, it's free. So skillshare.com/geek, sign up, try it out. And again, it's super affordable afterwards. So it's a great platform to be a part of. There's thousands of classes and there are new classes launching all the time. Big thanks, as always, to Skillshare, additionally, for supporting this show, and let's get back into it. All right, we got question number two coming up. I like to write fiction, lyrics, poetry, sometimes stories, but I find that I can only maintain the energy to write for very short periods of time because I quickly feel drained and exhausted mentally. How can I overcome this? So, this is a question that you sent to me.
Yeah.
And I was actually thinking, because you had mentioned it's about fiction, I was thinking that it was going to be more about fiction writing in general, but this seems like a more general.
It could work for a lot of things. I liked the fiction angle because I got to ask Ashley, who has been working a lot on writing a novel, writing fiction for a while. She did a couple of NaNoWriMos, a bunch of stuff. So I thought that was an interesting angle. But yeah, this is very much could apply to pretty much any level of creativity, any sort of creation.
Yeah. Well, I asked Anna about this, and she was like, well, if they feel mentally exhausted after a short period of time, do they actually like to write fiction? Hmm. But I wonder if there's a, you know, more subtle problem here. It's tough. Personally, I don't write fiction, but I make music. And sometimes I find myself completely immersed in the process of production. I'm very much enjoying myself. Sometimes I'm very happy with what comes out of it, but producing it, I'm not always like super into it.
Yeah.
That's especially true for writing. And I don't really write a whole lot of fiction, but with nonfiction, like sometimes I'm very into the process of writing, and sometimes it is like pulling teeth to get those words down on the computer screen. But once they're there, I'm happy with it. I don't know. What are your thoughts on overcoming the mental exhaustion aspect?
Well, so I did ask Ashley what she's been doing for this sort of thing. The thing that fueled her writing the best is that she's had clear daily goals. Almost in any calendar month where she's felt successful, it's been like the official NaNoWriMo, where there's a community and there's a set goal you're reaching. Like if I write X number of words a day, I'm done. So when you're feeling mentally exhausted, in that case, with a clear output-based goal or an input-based time goal, you can just say, I only have to push this much further.
Yeah.
There's a boundary you can reach and say, I'm good now. So if you're exhausted and you want to keep going, that might be a little more motivating than I'm going to keep going until I pass out at this desk and hate myself. Like having a clear, I won, I'm done for the day is all right.
But I could actually, yeah, that makes sense, because maybe mental exhaustion can be partially caused by a mismatch between your expectations and what you are actually able to produce. And yeah, if you're going in every single day being like, I'm going to write an entire chapter of this novel, and then you write 1,000 words, you might feel bad about it.
Yeah, you might have unrealistic expectations. So if you set a clear, preferably much more realistic goal, you could say, I'm going to push through the exhaustion. And not all mental exhaustion is bad. This isn't writing, but when I'm practicing, I do language lessons and language conversations to practice Spanish, French, Japanese. They feel the best when I'm mentally exhausted. But I know that there's a time limit after which that conversation will end for the day.
Yeah.
And I can finally rest my weary brain. And that means if I just push a little harder, I can feel really good about pushing. And if I pushed forever, I would get sick of it probably. Mm-hmm. But I also write, you know, I've written plenty of lyrics, and that's generally not fiction. Most of my lyrics are either allegories to my real life or literally my real life, especially when writing rap, which can be very, very literal compared to other genres and still come across as good. Mm-hmm. But I always went on walks to write lyrics, always.
Mm.
If I sat down, like you were saying at the beginning of this podcast, if I sat down and I was like, I'm going to write this song, just be like, I got nothing. And that doesn't work for me. I had to wait for a string of thought to appear while walking. And so I'd walk around the university campus, or I'd rollerblade, and I'd have an iPad, a wireless keyboard, and this little drawstring like tennis bag that I'd just roll around with. And as soon as that single thought hit me, I'd be like, that line, I think that's something. I'd just sit down wherever, the nearest building or bench, and start writing. But as soon as that went away and I was like, I'm confused again, I didn't just sit there. I put it back in my bag, ran off, and then tried to find inspiration and loosely think about it. I find the, what's that called? The mode of your brain where you're letting it kind of bounce around freely.
The default mode.
Yeah. It's much better for me to do creative writing through that.
Yeah.
I get exhausted real quick with it. And I mean, I added an entire extra section to the lyrics for the song I'm working on like 8 months after I wrote the initial song. And I was like, that's good. But I never would have sat there long enough to come up with whatever thoughts popped in my head 8 months later.
Yeah. I've been reading the book Hyperfocus by Chris Bailey. And he kind of gives those two modes of thinking names. So there's hyperfocus, where you're sitting down, you know, very intensely focused on whatever you're doing. And then scatter focus, which is basically just engaging the default network, which I've also called the diffused mode. That's what Barbara Oakley calls it in her book. That's when you have creative insights. And what you are doing, going around in your rollerblades, just sort of engaging with the world, going and doing something you enjoy that doesn't take a ton of your attentional space, like that is, that's kind of like the way you have those creative insights and those connections and how things come to you.
Yeah.
So, and maybe so one thing that I thought of here, which is kind of related, is I wonder if this person is experiencing mental exhaustion because they are trying to combine the act of creation with the act of editing. This is something I struggle with all the time. I'll write something and I'll immediately doubt it. Like, is that the perfect way to phrase that sentence? And the best writing that I do always comes from me sitting down and focusing just on getting the words out of my brain, not worrying about if they're the most eloquent prose that I've ever written, just get the ideas out, get the sentences written. And then I come back after a break to edit.
Yeah, absolutely. Because that totally slows me down too. And again, with lyrics, what I'll do for that is I'll write down, like, if I'm singing it or if it fits into a rap meter somehow, I'll write down another phrase that either rhymes the way I want it to but is nonsense, or, you know, sings the way I want it to, but it's not really mm-hmm. related to anything. And I'll be like, so that's how it, if I were humming it, that would sound right.
Yeah.
But it might take me another day or two to come up with even one of the words that's yeah. correct. And if yeah, if I didn't write it down until it was correct, I would not write it down. I would mm-hmm. lose it probably.
Yeah. I mean, I guess like with lyrics, it's not just the words. You have to figure out like how many syllables.
Yeah. How many syllables sounds good
here?
What kind of tone should I be going with? If you're matching it up with music, you doing all that at once would be horrible. Trying mm-hmm. to, if I'm going to sit down and I'm trying to write like a novel and I'm just like, okay, I'm going to write the final page one, go. That's not even possible for like professional authors who go through several rounds of edits.
Yeah.
You know, after they've put in years into a book and the editor's just like, yeah, that first page, nah, here's what you got to do. And you're crushed because you put so many hours into it. And you're like, how come it's still not perfect?
Yep.
It's just not yeah. going to be. That's.
Yeah. I mean, I'm well aware that there is an entirely different part of my brain that is engaged when I'm in pure creation mode. There's a study about. I mean, we've talked about this before, but there's a study about freestyle rappers in an MRI machine. And when they freestyle rap, it's a completely different section of the brain that lights up than when they're doing stuff from memory or, you know, trying to be a little more focused on it. One of my favorite things I've done in the last probably 6 months is I got the new Apple Watch. And I couldn't really get into the first Apple Watch, but this one has a couple of things. The fitness tracking is much better, which I love. But I have a complication, which is just their weird fancy term for putting a shortcut to an app on your home screen of the watch. I have a complication for the voicemails app. So I don't even have to get my phone out. I can just boop, hit my wrist, and I'm in two taps recording a voicemail. Cool. So I will just start recording and I'll grab my guitar and just start strumming away. And if I'm going for lead stuff, I'll just start noodling. It's fine. You know, it's whatever comes out. Or if I'm going for lyrics, the other day I was just playing guitar and I was playing this chord progression that I've been practicing, looking at a YouTube page. And I just started like picking words out of the titles in the suggested videos and just working them into weird nonsensical lyrics that make no sense, have no meaning, no cohesive message being communicated, just lyrics. And there's stuff in there that I would love to work into real songs. I will have to replace the words, but that's not the point of the initial act of creation. It's just what sounds good singing along with this chord progression. There's a really great John Mayer video where he's talking to a radio host about how to become a songwriter. And he said, you kind of have to just get to this point where you are absolutely fearless about doing this, about grabbing the guitar, strumming some chords, and just making up random crap and singing it. And I mean, that dude is absolutely fearless. He grabs his guitar in the interview and just starts making up weird, stupid lyrics. Some of them are not even lyrics. Some of them are just pure gibberish. And the radio host is sitting right in the room. You know, he's doing it publicly on live radio. And he's just totally okay with it. It's because he knows that what he's creating is not the final form, but it is what will get him to the final form. So there's no reason to be embarrassed about the kind of garbagey state of what is initially created.
Yeah.
So that would be my one tip here is if you can separate those two acts, separate creation from editing, and I think you'll find that you have less mental exhaustion because you don't have two sides of your mind warring against each other at the same time. All right, question number three. How do I stop binging so much TV without giving up my favorite shows?
It's
a good question.
Yeah.
Especially now that, you know, TV's like designed
pretty
to
much
let you binge.
The norm now, yeah.
It's really tough.
For this, I'd probably give the same advice that I'd give if one plays too many video games, which, you know, I do from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a lot of success limiting entirely to like Friday and Saturday so that I'm allowed to binge on those days if I want, if I can't give them up.
Mm-hmm.
If that's easier than having a little bit each day. Sometimes I find cold turkey on more days to be way easier than not slipping in and accidentally playing for like four more hours than I thought. Like it's better to just say, not at all. And then Friday, lose your mind, go for it.
Mm-hmm.
But Yeah, I get sucked into TV pretty easily sometimes, especially if it's been a hard week mentally or emotionally. I'll start to like vicariously feel stuff through the characters, and then I'll feel really weird when I disconnect, so I'll need to keep watching. And that's probably not good for my productivity or my emotional well-being to end up that deep into the show.
That's why finishing books sucks.
Oh, I feel like
I have to leave this universe. Ah, damn it.
I feel like finishing a book, to me, it feels like I'm practicing dying, not to be too morbid, but I lived this whole life in this book and I now must end it. And that it's like, no matter what the book was, it's always feels powerful to end it because I got so into it. But yeah, the best thing that I've done for those is doing some sort of a 5-day rule, or if I have to limit it to, I'm going to do a little bit and then not more every day or something, that works best for me before the sun has retreated to our neighboring hemisphere. During the day, it's way easier for me to disconnect and get back to something else. I'll go for a walk, or the sunlight will fuel me and I'll get creative and do something else. If it's nighttime, I feel like if I'm in my house sitting down watching TV or playing games at night, time stops existing. So it's way harder for me to disconnect at night.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I just basically have a time that I go to bed.
So, yeah, that would be reasonable. I try that. I'm not that great at it lately.
Due to quarantine, has gone up like an hour and a half.
Yeah.
But I get the same amount of work done, so I'm kind of okay with it. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, that. I think I just have enough in my life that I'm also committed to, that there's just not a whole lot of time left over for TV.
That's fair. As long as the other things can pull you out of like that world.
Yeah. But I mean, sometimes I do get sucked in. So I think sometimes, like if it's rare, it's fine to binge a show. My question would be, how many favorite shows do you have? And if you have a ton of favorite shows, maybe your life is a little unbalanced.
Yeah, if you're bouncing back and forth between huge things like The Office or Avatar, and you're just, I'm going to rewatch that next week. Mm-hmm. That might be a problem.
Like last weekend, I binged the entire first season of Little Witch Academia in one day. But I know a lot of people who do things like that. When they finish a season or they finish a show, their immediate next question is, okay, what's the next show I'm going to watch? And for me, that's not the question. For me, it's like, cool, I did that. What do I want to do next? It's probably, you know, I want to go outside and rollerblade or make some music or go work or hang out with friends. It's, I don't ask myself like, what's the next version of this medium that I can consume? That's because I don't want to get into a habit of being like, I always have a show.
Like put a buffer.
I always need a show.
Put like a buffer space in between, yeah. So that you get used to the idea that you're not always watching something. That makes sense.
Just don't let your identity be a TV buff. You know, I love movies, but I'm not a movie buff. I'm not somebody who watches movies every single night. That's just not valuable to me. There are other things I'd rather be doing with my time. But that allows me to still watch movies on a frequent basis. But it's not like, all right, what's the next movie I'm going to watch? What's the next show I'm going to watch? I'm a show watcher.
Yeah.
So, right now, we're watching Invader Zim.
Oh, that's
which is
one.
Impossible to binge. The show is so ridiculous. I'll watch one episode and I'm like, all right, that was funny. I'm good. I can't sit there and laugh for like a full hour. My temples will hurt. Whereas like Little Witch was completely bingeable and I didn't want to stop watching. So I don't always want to have a show like that I'm in the middle of. And I don't always want to have like a fiction book I'm in the middle of. I've been reading Seven Eves, and you know, if I'm not careful, I'll spend 2 hours reading, which like I want to read every day, but I don't want to spend 2 hours a day reading because I got other things going on. I'll cut in my work time. Okay, so question number 4. I've been offered an internship at a company that wants to hire me after graduation, but the work is unrelated to what I'm studying. Is it a good idea to take advantage of this offer, or would it be better to make sure my first job is related to my major? This is a heavy question. And tough for me to answer as somebody who completely ignored my major technical focus with regards to my career.
Yeah. I mean, I use some of what I learned in my daily life now, but I will say that a large portion of what I do these days is not something I learned in school, and the degrees did not really matter. So this is a weird position.
But you know what? I am entirely confident that if I wanted to go into some management information systems related field, I could do it.
Yeah, they're not going to be like the black sheep of the management information systems world, where they're just like, oh yeah, you thought you could stray? You're never coming back.
Yeah, I don't believe that if I were to get an interview, they'd be like, well, why'd you spend all this time in media production? You know, maybe they'd ask that question, but then I could answer it. I did this, but I still have the skills for this position, and this is what I want to do now.
Yeah.
And if I didn't have the skills for that particular position, I may have to go for something a little bit more entry level. And I guess that's something to consider here. Like, if you go into a different field, are you going to spend a lot of time in that field, or are you going to be using it as kind of like a stopover and working on getting back into the field that you majored in?
Yeah. And is the field you majored in one where you have to climb up the ranks for a long time? And if so, how much progress are you sacrificing?
Yeah. Like, this is probably a question to actually discuss with a career counselor who can look at your individual situation, look at the specific fields that you're going into. Some fields are looking to hire people right out of school, and they're going to be more biased towards that than others. Like, I would say IT is a field where it doesn't actually matter that much that you go into it right after school. But maybe, like, the medical field might be a little more rigid in that respect, or law might be a little more rigid in that respect. So, you know, talk to somebody who's knowledgeable in your specific field. Talk to a career counselor, do informational interviews with people who actually work in companies within your field, and ask them, like, you know, what would your management or your recruiters think of somebody who went to school for this, but then got an experience in a different area? Would it be a red flag? Would I still have to basically start an entry-level position? Would experience over here actually give me something that would give me a leg up going back into this field? There's a lot of different questions here. But the big one is, you know, do you want to take a detour? Is it worth it to you? And why is it worth it to you? Is it just for money? Do you need that money? Do you have a ton of student debt right now that you have to pay off? Or is it just... is it just like, you know, the first good opportunity you've gotten and it feels like you'd be letting the door slam on something really important if you pass it up?
Yeah. Or are you pivoting entirely and you just, like, secretly you want to do this kind of job, but you feel guilty about it because it's not what you studied? Although in that case, I would say, who cares? As long as what you want to do will pay for the bills that you incurred to study what you studied, in that case, I wouldn't concern myself with what I studied before.
The sunk cost fallacy, because that can clear, or that can cloud our judgment many times, where we're like, well, I want to do this, it's a good opportunity, but I've already been doing this, and it would just be a waste to let all that go by the wayside. Well, number one, it's not a waste if whatever weird windy path that you've been on so far has gotten you to an opportunity that you find fulfilling and worthwhile. And even if it is a waste, like, let it be a waste, because I would rather have something be a waste in my path, in my past, and be happy with what I'm doing now, than to be miserable doing what I'm doing now, but have some, like, proud justification in my head that, you know, doing it is somehow propping up my past decisions.
Yeah.
I don't want that. I would rather do what makes me happy.
Yeah, past you actually isn't around anymore to judge you for what you're currently doing, so I wouldn't be beholden to them.
Nope, unless past me discovers time travel. I'm going to come to the future and they're going to scold me. How dare you?
If past you discovers time travel before current you, you should probably just do whatever they say, because I don't know how that works.
It's because future me went back in time.
It's getting real weird.
And gave the time travel tech to past me.
They didn't even go to current you. They were just like,
past me.
We need past you to do this.
This causes the timeline to split. But then past me is like, no, screw that. I'm going into the old timeline with this time travel tech to yell at current I mean, future.
Yeah, you got to get back to the past, Samurai Jack. Obviously,
is that my destiny?
I think
so. Become a samurai who fights robots.
That's not a bad destiny.
That's the only destination for any time travelers, to eventually end up being a samurai.
Yeah,
who's going back to the past?
Don't even bother if that's what you're doing.
I want them to make more of that new Samurai Jack series. That was so good. It was really good.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's a heavy question. I'm sorry we don't have like a more concrete answer for you, but the truth of it is there isn't a concrete answer because we're talking about your future. And ultimately, you're going to chart that course. The biggest thing I would say is be aware of that sunk cost fallacy and then get information about your specific major area. If that's what you really want to be in, ask people who are knowledgeable. Is taking an opportunity in a new field going to be a detour that will hurt me in the long run?
Yeah.
You know? All right. Last question. What are your thoughts on other YouTubers who have said they don't think self-help books are worth anything?
By which I assume we will answer what we think about that opinion rather than I don't care. I don't know the YouTubers who said that and I don't have an opinion on them, but I can have an opinion on that opinion.
If you don't read self-help books, you're going to fail.
Oh,
and
no.
Furthermore, if you don't join my 7,000 steps to financial freedom success program, only $2,000 per month, but it's a recurring charge, but I'm not going to tell you about that. It's in fine print. If you don't join that, you're not going to live up to your full potential. You're going to be a failure in life. And your kids are going to be starving, and they're going to be looking up at you with sad, watery eyes. They're going to be like, Daddy, why didn't you subscribe to Thomas's 7,000 Steps to Financial Freedom? Now we're starving, and we have to eat rats.
Yep.
One slip is all it takes. Not taking out that credit card. Not
one
putting
slip.
In them digits.
One slip. You got to buy my patent-pending graph with smiley stickers that I used to reward myself, and now I'm a billionaire. And I'm pretty sure it was the smiley stickers, and you need those.
I developed this goal-tracking journal. And if you want to live the life that I'm living right now, because I wasn't always like this. I didn't have this mansion. I didn't have these fancy cars. I didn't have this super hot wife before, but then I journaled. Now,
that's absolutely the crucial decision.
I just invented this journal, so clearly I wasn't writing in this journal when I was becoming successful. I was writing in a random like Mead 5-star notebook from Walmart. But if you don't buy this journal, you will never get all these things.
It's true. Guaranteed.
It makes me so angry because like AdSense is a not insignificant part of our revenue, so I can't just turn it off. But there's so many of these people who advertise, they target my content. So like
we're trying to do productivity stuff, but there's a lot of iffy stuff in that world, unfortunately.
So many shysters.
Yeah.
All right. I went off on a tangent. Self-help books are content like any other content. An idea from a self-help book could be given to you by your dad in a conversation before you go out onto the football field. It could be written on a building. It could be anywhere. It's an idea. So for people who say, you know, a self-help book is worthless, it's just a way of communicating ideas, which may be very helpful to you.
Yeah, you can't say that about them in general. You can use them in a way that makes them useless. If you could read one book, actually use the ideas or one idea contained inside, and you could never need another one. Or you could read 10 more books thinking you need all the ideas in the world, use none of them because you thought, you know, once again, like earlier, I'm not ready to be productive or happy until I have the perfect formulas in every aspect. At that point, they're actually, I wouldn't say that they're worthless. I would say they're worse than worthless because at that point you're using them as a crutch to keep you from doing anything.
Yeah. This actually comes right back around to the whole consumption to production ratio.
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of people who are like, I read 100 self-improvement books. I'm a guru now. And it's like, you haven't done anything. You just consumed other people's advice. That's
yeah. And you probably didn't even use it. You just, you let it pass through your head and you're hoping that through like osmosis somehow.
Yeah.
You will just be better at stuff. At that point, they're not worthless. They're of negative value and you're hurting yourself with them.
So here's some truth bombs for y'all. some hashtag truth knowledge bombs, like bath bombs that come from Bed Bath Knowledge Bombs and Beyond. When you're a public figure, you can rally more support to your cause when you make simple, clear statements that don't involve a lot of nuance and waffling. You could take this one piece of advice and go become a very successful demagogue if you want. Make simple, sometimes wrong, almost certainly wrong because they're not nuanced, but simple, concrete statements.
Yeah, nuanced stuff.
Self-improvement books are worthless. You don't need those. So much easier to remember than, well, self-improvement books, you know, they're not inherently worth less or worth something. It's really what you do with them. And, you know, we have to actually consider the self-improvement book as a singular thing. Excuse me, sir,
that's a lot of words.
It's a lot of words.
I wanted like two words max.
That wasn't like the best words.
Book good or book bad. I didn't really want you to go.
I only need a whole three sentence. Words in my vocabulary, U, S, and A.
That's it. That's the
so
advice.
That's one thing. The other thing is if you can define a clear enemy for your platform or your cause to oppose, it makes you stand out more. It defines
people
you
do love an enemy
by providing some contrast. So some people out there, let's just take Gary Vaynerchuk for an example. Now, I don't want to say his idea here is necessarily wrong or right, but Gary Vaynerchuk is well known for saying college is useless. Don't go to college. You could learn so much more by being an entrepreneur, getting your hands dirty, getting experience in the real world. And to a degree, he has a point. To a degree, there are things in that message worth considering. But I don't parrot that point because, again, there's nuance here. Some people thrive as autodidacts. Some people thrive going out into the big wide world with no plan and figuring things out for themselves. Some people thrive under an inordinate amount of structure. For some people, joining the military is like the best thing they could ever do because there's somebody there night and day directing them on almost every single decision, and that's what they need at a certain point in their lives. So to put out a giant message, you know, one size does not fit all. But it does define, here's us, here's them. They're the red, they're the skins, we're the shirts. And it's very simple. People are very tribalistic. So when you craft a simple message that defines an enemy and lets your audience in part define their identity by their opposition to the enemy that they think is lesser or somehow wrong, then people love to gravitate towards that.
It's actually like it feels so much easier to connect with somebody when you're like, we both hate that. That's like that's almost a stronger glue than we both like flowers, but we both hate bees. They're stupid, ugh, which is a very weird position. Yeah, I just said the first word that came to my mind, but that doesn't make sense at all. They should reconsider.
They should reconsider. Can't have flowers without bees.
Yeah, well, doesn't. Could. Yeah, that doesn't. Their position is a little tenuous, but you're going to connect way easier on mutual opposition to something just because it feels so right. Like our tribal nature is desperate for something to say is not part of what I'm about. I'm not about that life. Hashtag be life. Not for me.
Yeah, exactly. You know, opposition to something is very emotionally charged, you know, and we love to feel justified in our emotional
self-righteous anger. Is like one of the most, it's like a drug of a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Like it doesn't feel good. It still feels very negative, but it also, you're like, but it does feel good in a way.
Like, how often do you find yourself compulsively scrolling through the replies in a Twitter thread about, you know, something you agree with?
Wait.
Yeah, don't. But when somebody retweets somebody who's like said something completely stupid, you go into the replies and you're just like, scroll in self-righteous indignation. Yeah, this person's an idiot. And I know 1,000 people have told them they're an idiot, but I really, really, really want to tell them they're an idiot too. It's kind of like one of the problems with the internet.
Yeah.
If your video breaks, then we'll have a break in the video. It's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. My storage might be full.
For people listening, Martin we'll has see to what film happens. On an iPhone right now.
Oh, I just filled my phone. If I can't fix it, we'll just like stick a cool picture of me up there.
We'll put the Pixel Llama on there?
It won't matter. Yeah.
Can you make Pixel Martin?
I'm going to draw Pixel Martin riding the Pixel Llama, actually. Well, now I've committed to it. So that's what's going to be there. My phone's full. Perfect. I'm not even going to bother. We're on the fifth question. We'll end with a Pixel Martin riding a Pixel Llama. That's going to be the last part of the video for my side.
Sounds good to me. All right. So here's my nuanced point about self-help books that people are not going to like as much as a strong statement. Some self-help books are chock full of great ideas. They have a wonderful signal to noise ratio. And some self-help books are glorified business cards for the author.
It's like one blog post that's been stretched into 800 words for no reason.
Yeah, and the productivity pages and self-improvement space is egregious here, with people who will take an idea that could be communicated in a blog post or two sentences.
Like a tweet, maybe.
Like, I didn't know this. Apparently there's a book for the Pomodoro technique.
You could tweet how that works.
Set a timer for 25 minutes. Work on one task for 25 minutes. If you get distracted, write down what distracted you and go back to work. Then take a 5-minute break.
Yeah.
I'm going to get sued because the book.
Yeah.
I don't talk very much about the Pomodoro technique anymore because I made a video about it. And then like the guy's lawyer reached out and they're like, you're using a trademarked term in your title for your video. We want you to remove it. Which, number one, if you're talking about a trademark,
that's fair use.
I'm allowed to put the word McDonald's in a YouTube title. Yeah, is McDonald's good for you? I'm not allowed to build a product in the McDonald's system. I can't have that. But like, if I'm like writing an editorial piece about McDonald's, I'm allowed to do that. Second of all, though, my video on the Pomodoro technique starts out by crediting that guy for making it and linking to his website.
Huh.
So if the dude is so petty that he's going to go and make, number one, completely false and unjustifiable claims that you're wrongly using his trademark, and his trademark is just set a timer to do work, I just don't see a big reason to promote his idea anymore. Because, you're setting a timer.
Yeah, the timer could be any shape. Doesn't
like, if you're going to come up with a really simple idea that's not all that innovative, don't be petty about it. That's a bad combination.
Yeah.
Make things that are
great,
difficult.
Not a great look, I'd have to say.
Make things that are worthwhile. And then be humble. Be cool. Be chill. Just come on, man. Anyway, there's a filtration process here. You can use Goodreads for it. You can use Amazon reviews for it. You can use the opinions of people you trust. Like I trust Derek Sivers. He's got a great book notes page on his website where he takes the notes from every book he reads and he publishes them for free. So if you want to, you can just read the notes if you want. But he also gives his verdict. This book was worth reading. This book was, just a bunch of filler. So my position on this is that, self-help books could be worthwhile, but you need to figure out, is the self-help book that I'm going to read, is it worth taking 8 hours to go through 300 pages, or is it just a bunch of padding and maybe one useful idea? So here's my parting thought on it. Don't finish bad books.
Yeah.
Start a book, you paid for it, sunk cost. If it sucks, put it down, move on to the next one. There are a lot of books out there and a lot of other experiences to have in this world. Don't waste your precious time on a bad book.
Yeah, like you said, it's like 8 hours or something. Or if you tried to read the Da Vinci biography, super huge, and you're not into reading something that heavy, just listen to our podcast on it and then use that extra months that you're going to get back to learn how to make French food. Do something. You can do anything with that time.
Yeah, exactly. So just be a little bit more judicious about the things you choose to read. And I like this term from hyperfocus, which I would say for people who maybe want to learn how to focus better, the signal to noise ratio in hyperfocus is very good. One of the ideas that he had in that book was make things bid for your attention constantly.
Nice. So, you can do like an auctioneer voice in your head.
Yeah. Do I hear 2 minutes? Do I hear 3 minutes? Do I hear 4 minutes? 5 minutes sold to this stupid Twitter thread about Ariana Grande being mad at a TikTok star. Why did I do this? But if you think about it in that way, like, all right, this thing that I'm currently considering paying attention to, it is not in a vacuum. It is not the only thing I could pay attention to. And, oh, I can see over here that this interesting book is bidding a little bit higher in terms of the value it's going to offer me. So the TikTok Twitter thread loses out. The fluffy business book that's really just a blog post with a bunch of filler loses out. Because my attention must be bid for.
Yeah, and that's really a realistic way to look at it anyway, because you're not going to be able to do literally everything every day. They are doing that, whether you want to view it that way or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You just got to think about it a little more proactively. So, that's five questions.
That it is.
Bada bing, bada boom. Like we mentioned in the intro, send us your intro ideas. I would love to know what this podcast is a bad, terrible resource for, and the more ridiculous, the better. It's a terrible Peruvian llama breeding training program. Terrible for that. Until we come out with our episode on it.
On llama breeding.
Llama breeding. I did. A bunch of people have been tweeting me this story about how apparently they're... I haven't been able to read the story because it's behind a paywall, but the headline is apparently saying, like, we're going to get coronavirus antibodies from llamas.
That's
cool. I don't know the details, but
that's cool, I guess.
Llamas are nature's greatest warriors.
I'm not that
surprised.
Informed on the antibodies of the llama population.
Well, maybe it should be.
Maybe they got some good ones.
Get some learning done. All right. Yeah. This is episode 295. So if you want to get the show notes for this episode, cigpodcast.com/295 is where you can go. Otherwise, go over to CIGpodcast.com with no trailing slashes or numbers to find out how to subscribe to the show. If you haven't already done so, we are on Spotify, YouTube, Pocket Casts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, all the podcast things. And when this show changes its name and branding, it will be on the exact same feed. So all you got to do is go subscribe right now if you haven't. And make sure you keep subscribing. That's it. What else? What else do you do in an ending spiel for a podcast? Oh, yeah, you beg people for reviews on Apple Podcasts because my validation in life is not derived from the pride I take in my work, like I said earlier. No. Secretly, all of my validation, self-worth, and pride in who I am as a human being is derived by getting 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, and I need more. I need more stars.
Or if you want to take Thomas Frank down, put down some 1-star reviews, you know, and then he'll be crushed because he relies on those for sustenance.
There is nothing inside. I am empty. A husk. Remember the game Number Munchers? I'm like Star Muncher.
Oh no.
And I'm starving. You don't have enough stars. Otherwise, you can share it with a friend. And I think that's about it. We're back to weekly videos on the Thomas Frank channel. Because I'm back on that Beeminder game, baby.
Yep.
Back relying on external systems that keep me in a balanced place instead of relying purely on willpower, which doesn't always work.
Nope.
Simply doesn't always work. So check those out, youtube.com/ThomasFrank. And I also got bonus stuff, music stuff, all kinds of fun stuff going up on my Instagram at Tom Frankly. And Martin has cool photos, and sometimes pixel art, and sometimes music.
That's true.
So yo Martholomew for his Instagram. That is it. Thanks for listening. Bye. Oh, yeah, stay tuned.